Hello, everyone. Rob here. It's the Highlands Bunker Podcast. First segment today is just Carl and me. As you guys have learned by now, a great comrade and friend of ours, John A. Kowalko Jr., passed away over the weekend. And we're going to produce, a retrospective a little bit, just talk about his legacy, what he meant to us, what lessons we can learn from him. And so, yeah, we have a lot of people coming in, going to be giving their testimony and talking about it. So before we let them do it, I guess I'll do it first. Yeah, I guess most of this I'll break character a little bit. A lot of politicos and sort of adjacent people in Delaware never really understood what it is we're trying to do here with independent media, with the podcast and the call and everything. And I think it's just sort of like it's never been done before. So, you know, the first instinct of the powerful people is just to shut it down, to stigmatize it, to belittle it, to shit on it and all of that stuff, and basically say it's no good. And that's fine, because what we're really doing, and I think Carl would agree with this, is we're trying to suss out bullshit. And because we work in the political world, actually everybody does, but you know, we focus on that work, it's really important for us to be able to identify bullshit. Our detector has to be very good, number one. Number two is that when we detect it, we have to draw attention to it so that people can act accordingly. One of the people who helped me ensure that my tools, my detectors were calibrated properly is John Kowalko. Because whatever he did in public, whether it was going with us to argue against the Amazon plant, whether it was the work he did at DelCog, at the Coalition for Open Government, all the work he did in the legislature arguing for everyone. Everyone's a stakeholder. What he did to make sure that state pensioners get what they were promised as far as health care, all of it. You knew that when he said it, he meant it. And he would tell you if he made a mistake, and he would tell you how he felt about things. It's very, very rare. And that is the biggest lesson that Kowalko taught me, is that you can be authentic, you can be yourself, and you can be unafraid. And, you know, he took a lot of beats for that. We'll talk about some of them, I guess. Carl mentioned some of them in the piece that he wrote. But it's not really about that. Because if somebody is going to undermine your work, if somebody's going to stab you in the back, if somebody's going to use whatever modicum of power or whatever vicinity to the levers that they have to, you know, marginalize you, disenfranchise you, kick you off your committees, not run your bills, It doesn't matter, because those people, they're disingenuous. They're not authentic. And they're always, always, always going to ensure that the most powerful and the most influential people in this state get theirs first. And if you ever get anything, it's almost by mistake. It's, you know, you can yell about it enough and organize enough, and maybe you'll get a crumb or two crumbs or three crumbs. But to me, the most important thing is that you were your authentic self, that you did your work. Like, people say somebody's a real one. Well, he was a real one. And, you know, he did things in public, and his legacy and his memory will live on. A lot of other people's won't. Let's put it like that. Oh, baby, it's not possible. From the shadow of Rockford Tower, behind enemy lines, in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast, I'm Rob. This is the Highlands Bunker Podcast. Carl's in to record with me today. We also have others going to be coming in, talking about their experiences, talking about just their personal relationship. And we'll get to all of that in due course. Carl... you were able to, as you normally do, put stuff, you know, write something down for everyone. And I really, I knew you would, but I really appreciated the framing of it and somebody who carried the torch, you know, and was unafraid to lead, and to build, you know, a group of progressive, democratic, socialist-minded people who looked at every constituent and every citizen and every person in this state as a stakeholder and as a constituent of theirs. And it was just cool that that was your, like, your framing right from the get-go. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I will say it is something I have... I mean, really, since he retired back in 2022, it's been something I've been thinking about to a certain extent. And, you know, it's been no secret that he's not in, was not in the best health for his last few years. So, you know, every once in a while you get a little bit of a reminder. He went through a lot of treatment and, like, he had his ups and downs. Like, he was on the podcast, I think, at least once or twice after retiring. So it's not like he was on death's door this whole time. But, you know, it's something that you think about, especially as we are building what we're building now, and just thinking about, I mean, this is a big part of a lot of the, I think, writing or research that I do, is like, I am generally of the opinion that none of us are particularly anything special when it comes to the ability to do this or that better than anybody else. I mean, it's my very egalitarian view, I'd like to say, that, like, you know, just because an amazing thing happens does not mean that the person who did it is amazing. You know, we all are capable of some things, not capable of some things. And so part of that goes back to looking at what allowed us to get to where we are right now. Like, whose shoulders are we standing on? And I think if we're talking about the Delaware left, you can't really point to anybody else more than you can point to John Kowalko. Because I think he was someone who, to kind of contradict my earlier point, I think he was unique in a way that he was able to do this for so long in a way that I don't know right now of anybody else who I think could do that in the same way. I mean, the closest example you'd have now is maybe Medina, but even in the things that she has to stand alone, there are, like, you know, enough WP people around her that can support that sort of thing. But he... I don't know how much I got this across in the piece, but the fact that he just did everything, because obviously he was an elected official. He introduced a lot of legislation that nobody else would have introduced, whether it was like single payer healthcare or the Inspector General bill, other stuff like that. But just the protesting that he did outside of office, the going to meetings, the writing his own budget, the helping found PDD, like he didn't just, he's someone who realized that the role of a legislator is not just to be in the building and to cut deals and make relationships, that you can actually use a position of public power in a broader way. And that is something that I don't really think that anybody in Delaware had done in recent history before he got elected in 2006. Because, as you know, I'm doing my research for like historical stuff, and that used to be more of a thing, say like the 60s, 70s, a bit. But even then, legislators kind of kept to their own little world. And I think he's someone who brought the practice of governance out into the light a little bit more, for better and for worse. And I don't think you get WFP without that, obviously, and the work that we're doing, but like not just WFP, but the whole ecosystem movement stuff. But I also think that like you get a worse government over, like, even regardless of any ideology, which, I mean, we're all about ideology. So like, I don't think the ideology is not the point, but I think if you just care about good governance, if you're like, that's the Inspector General thing, like bringing stuff out into the light, raising issues. The only way you would really would have known what's going on in the legislature between 2007 and 2020, essentially, is because John Kowalko was in the newspaper saying like, hey, they're trying to do this shit. It's fucked up. Sometimes in that exact language.
Sometimes, yeah.
And, you know, as people try to erode transparency and try to erode workers' rights and try to erode accountability and all these other things, he was the guy that was in there year after year, year after year. He obviously legislatively couldn't stop a lot of it by himself, but he did basically every single thing you could have done as one guy. He figured out how to do. And it just, like, you know, he built the toolbox that we all now have.
Yeah, it's amazing because I've told this story before, but I'll have to tell it today just because. In 2006, I was living in Newark. I was married to my first wife, and my life was pretty wild. But around that time, you know, everybody was getting real disenchanted with the Bush administration and the Iraq War and everything. And it was like, I can't believe it was sort of the first wave of like just absolute lying to your face on TV about stuff. And this guy who was my neighbor down the street, John Kowalko, I think we lived about seven houses away. We lived on the same street. And I knew who he was, but not really. And he was running against a Republican, but he was so good. He was saying like all of the right stuff. He wasn't, I had never heard anybody at a state level talk like that ever. And I was working at the bank. I had to go to a conference about loan software from auto dealerships to the bank. In Las Vegas. And it happened to be the week of elections, and I think I've mentioned it before. It was back when, you know, you had to go in, if you wanted an absentee ballot, you had to sign, like, the affidavit that you were going to be out of town. I was going to be on a business trip, and I cast my vote for John Kowalko. And I remember talking to my ex-wife from the Mandalay Bay Hotel and Casino that night. And I was like, hey, did you get election results? And I remember her saying, Kowalko won. I remember it like it was yesterday. And being like, okay, that's cool. You know, let's see where this goes. Well, it went somewhere. And yeah, he's been in the vanguard ever since. So, you know, it was tough. It was a tough night when I heard, just because but again, like you said, it wasn't, you know, he had been ill. He had been in here, I think, at least twice after his retirement. And then we spoke to him by phone or saw him at different events or whatever. And sometimes, you know, he would be in great spirits and sound fine. And other times, you know, if he was going through a treatment or a rough patch, you know, he would sound, you know, not good. But he never stopped doing the thing that you're talking about, like just calling the newspaper and being like, hey, they're trying to do this. It's fucked up. He never stopped doing that. You know, I'd get a call on my phone, John Kowalko. I'm like, somebody's doing something fucked up. He's got to tell me, you know, and I'm like, sometimes I'd show you guys, oh, he's calling, something's up. You know, so, you know, and you catalog, in the call piece, a lot of the things that he's done that really you almost don't think about, the What's the Matter with Delaware, the Hal Weitzman book about the corporate state and the franchise, you know, he comes out as a hero in that book. It should be remembered that every time we fight the corporate takeover of the state and of the legislature and of us, really, that whole thing kicked off because of that. I mean, it had always been my pet peeve. People knew about it. You know, people knew this is corporate state, what it was, and credit cards are here and all of that stuff. But the real, real fight started and was joined by Kowalko.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, around the 1980s, you get like a little bit of pushback as like the credit card piece specifically is being put in. You have a few local legislators that are like, I don't know about this, but in terms of like an actual concerted fight against just like unquestioned corporate dominance, as far as I'm aware, he's the only one before 2020 that ever really mentioned it in any sort of concerted way.
Yeah, and I think he said something to me, and I don't know if it's in the book or not, but you know, when he raised the issue that is cataloged in the book about, you know, going to the committee and basically objecting to just laying down and letting the corporations write, you know, what they could do, he was met with, this is not how we do it. We do it in this way. And I think what he did was reject that. He said, I can do it. I'm a representative. I can do it however I want to do it.
Yeah, we're in a democracy. I'm elected representative of the people, so I have as much of a right as anybody.
Yeah, and I think people forget that. People forget that, yes, there are individuals, quote, in leadership, unquote, who have their hands near small levers of power. And, you know, if you want to get your fucking chicken scratch bill, you know, in front of a committee in the next 4 years, you know, you better stay on the right side of them. I get that. But I think he was playing a different game. He was actually playing a different sport when it wasn't even a game. It was like, my job here is to do what I came here to do. And I'm not going to write a bullshit bill so I can get, you know, a hearing this year and make myself feel good. I'm here for a reason. Not like a cosmetic, you know, pat on the back reason. And so he rejected the Delaware way publicly. And, you know, there's a reason why we open the podcast the way we open it. And I hope I'll never, now that I open it that way, I'll never say those words in the belly of the Delaware Way beast without thinking of Kowalko, because he was really in the belly of the Delaware Way beast down there on the green in Dover. Did he, he went all the way through like progressive Democrats at Delaware. Wasn't there another iteration? Was it Leftward?
Leftward Delaware was, because that was the predecessor to WFP more explicitly. I mean, we talked with him at that point, but because, yeah, it wasn't as neat a like, oh, he's the one who like started all this stuff. Because it's weird, because he did, I think, as I put in there, and I didn't go through the whole story, because Working Families Party got started in 1998 in New York. And in the aughts, they were sort of expanded into a bunch of other states that had fusion voting where you could run on multiple different ballot lines. And the building trades in Delaware and Acorn were interested in bringing it to Delaware. And so he was one of the first. So they've got started in 2006, and he was first elected in 2006. So I don't know the full story, but he was like one of the first real WFP champions in the Delaware State Legislature. And it's funny because the other ones were like Terry Spence, or like, you know, like the former Speaker of the House, who's a Republican. And he actually got in because of like his opposition to busing, but then he was also like really pro labor for some reason. So,
we got a lot of that going on right now.
Yeah.
I mean,
so,
maybe not opposition to busing, because I guess you can't be opposed to busing now, but
yeah, well, there's no busing to be opposed to.
Yeah. Whatever the racist equivalent is in the year of our Lord 2025, you can be that and also be pro labor.
Yeah.
So that's nothing new.
So yeah, that was his connection with like the original. And so then in 2010, the Democratic Party decides we do not like fusion voting. So, or we do not like the Working Families Party. We do not like fusion voting. And so they abolished fusion voting.
Yeah.
So they can't do that anymore with the, at least on the fusion voting part. But yeah, so he was involved in that. And then obviously the more direct stuff lately is just when our first slate of folks got in 2020. And like, you know, they all kind of do different things. You know, people have their own roles, but everybody looked up to John Kowalko as, you know, if not like, I'm going to do exactly what you're doing, he's still at least a role model for like how to challenge the system.
Yeah. And people, and we've said it in here, I think I've said it to him, you know, the criticism is, you know, within the levers of power, you know, there was stuff that didn't get done. Because, you know, maybe there was a more strategic way to make those challenges. But honestly, when you're all by yourself, maybe there isn't.
Well, that's the thing, is like, I think some folks have a theory of change that, oh, if I am able to convince this person of the thing that I believe, that is how we get social change, is like through persuasion of elites. And I think there are certain cases where that is true. But I think if you're looking at fundamentally shifting the balance of power within society away from billionaires and corporations and cops and landlords and all that stuff and towards like working people, I think there's only so much you can do. Like, I don't think there's any amount of persuasion that John Kowalko could have done to raise the minimum wage more than it was raised before 2021.
Right.
And so at that point, yeah, you do basically have to confront yourself with the idea of like, okay, if I do not think that persuasion is a way to win the things that we need to win, then what are the other opportunities to me? And I think there's a lot of people in the legislature over the years who could show you how to do really good persuasion and how to like win people over, act nice, do the stuff. Like, there's plenty of people who can teach you how to do that, but then none of them can tell you how to do anything else. And I think that kind of gets back to the idea that John Kowalko, he tried everything else. Like, he was doing everything.
Yeah, not only that.
And some of it worked and some of it didn't. And, right, like, that's the thing. And in the legislature, you ultimately run into the barrier that you need to get 21 votes in the House and 11 votes in the Senate. And if you don't have people who are going to vote for you or for your stuff, then you can't pass legislation. But there's so much else you can do to either make change in other ways or to just like raise the awareness that is necessary to organize people to the point where they're going to get new people elected to get to those 11 or those 21. And so, like, you know, we have now taken like an electoral route on the WFP side, and there's other groups that are taking more social pressure routes. Like, there's a lot of different things, and not to say that John Kowalko was the first person to ever think about this, but in the case of Delaware, in the legislature, I can't think of anybody else who's doing anything like that.
Yeah, and I think to your point, some things get done via compromise and negotiation, but I can't imagine a path that we're going to compromise our way to Medicare for all. We're not going to compromise our way to the social change that you're talking about, that is necessary and deserved to every person in this country and this state. And so the idea that I can teach you how to politic and you know, all the little steps to go through and who to talk to and who to send this through. So you get, you know, 1/15th or, you know, of what you actually wanted. I think he looked at it like that's not what he's down for. Like, you know, we need huge social and political change, and we're not going to, we're not going to negotiate really our way to it. We're going to go in and say, this is what we're doing. We've brought these resources to bear and people to bear, and we've made the arguments, and we're not backing down, which is the route that he went. And again, he was ahead of his time. I had forgotten the Eggcorn part, and maybe you can talk a little bit about that and remind people what that was. Because as I mentioned earlier, I worked at banks all the way through. So, you know, there was always like, oh, be careful. Eggcorn might come in. Eggcorn's going to do this. They're bad, or they're commies. And I just sit in the back of the room and be like, well, they're right. You know, just be cool. But when I worked at Wells Fargo, we were attached to a financial division out of Des Moines, who had some of those like storefronts, strip mall storefronts. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like financial, like, you know,
yeah, yeah,
non-prime going there, whatever. Well, they were getting hit by Eggcorn in like direct action, like spot, you know, and they were like, we had to lock up the fucking, you know, the Edina, Minnesota financial shop because Eggcorn came, mm-hmm. you know. And they were really, really active. And I guess, is it fair to say, and maybe you don't remember, and you'd have to probably have read it, or you wouldn't remember.
No,
but
don't worry. I read the Eggcorn book.
Okay. Now,
and WFE is actually a direct descendant of Eggcorn. Like, yeah. Eggcorn is one of the founding members.
Yeah, and it's still, in the UK, they still have
Yeah, they
some
have
presence.
A bunch of international affiliates, yeah. yeah. They actually, I think, probably have more members now than they did before they collapsed in the U.S. But, yeah, they did collapse in the U.S.,
but I believe that, and maybe I shouldn't put so much weight on it, but Eggcorn was one of the first victims of the James O'Keefe,
yep,
the Project Veritas guy. I don't know if they were the very first victim of like the fake interview, like the underhanded interview thing where you pretend like,
yeah.
And I think he, I don't know, I forget what he did. Is that the one he dressed up like a pimp?
Yes, there was a thing about, yeah, something with pimps and prostitutes. I don't know the full details, because yeah, this is all well before my time. Yeah. But yeah, basically Eggcorn was a community organizing, like a community union, basically. Like, they would go into a neighborhood of like low and moderate home income homeowners or renters and just organize people, start meeting with them and say like, what's going on in your community? How can we get together and change it? So it was a direct descendant of the National Welfare Rights Organization, which was a big thing in the late 60s, early 70s, which came out of the civil rights, like the sort of the more radical edge of the civil rights movement. And yeah, they were focused on like black and brown communities across the country. I don't know when Delaware Eggcorn really got its start. I think it was sometime in the 90s or early aughts. Because we're always a little bit behind the times on that. And yeah, so they would do a whole bunch of different stuff. They did voter registration drives. They did issue campaigns. They would target organizations, banks, push for different policies, you know, get the stoplight on the street fix, like, you know, all sorts of different stuff. And a couple things happened. So at a certain point, they started in the 70s, and they started to get pretty big to the point where they were also getting like government contracts to do things like voter registration. But what got them in trouble ultimately is that they did do voter registration, and they registered like a million low income black and brown people, which was a part of why Obama, it's not the main reason, but it's a part of why Obama got elected in 2008. And the Republicans did not like that. And so, yeah, this like conservative influencer basically staged a video to make it look like they were sheltering prostitutes or something like that. And it became a big thing. Republicans raise a big stink. Democrats throw them under the bus and sort of defund all the federal ends. And there was like a couple other internal scandals as well. So the whole thing in America fell apart fairly quickly. But They were very active in Delaware. And even if you look at like some of the Occupy Delaware back when it was in the Peter Spencer Plaza in like 2010, 11 or whatever it
was.
Just
thinking about that.
A lot of the people who were there were former Acorn people. Like Darlene Battle was one of their biggest people, but like April Walker, there's other ones that I'm sure that I'm misremembering, but John Cuoco, as far as I was not around as much, so I don't know how involved he was, but he was involved with that. He was involved with some of the, you know, progressive organizations sort of in the gulf that kind of opened up in between like 2008 and 2016. He was involved. If there was a progressive organization, he was probably involved in it somehow.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, I remember even in Delaware, people at banks talking about Acorn. Yeah, I had a surreal moment. I think I've told it, but I'll tell it again since you brought it up. You know, the Occupy Delaware encampment was at Peter Spencer Plaza on French Street, very aptly, you know, placed there. And I remember in 2010, I guess, whenever it was, 9, 10, going down and finding out what kind of, like, supplies they needed. So I went and bought a bunch of camping stuff for them and, like, donated it, just tried to kit them out with, like, stuff they could prepare food and all that stuff. And, of course, my life was in it was in a pretty big downward spiral by this point. And I had to get another bank job. I had been laid off, and I took that money to, like, party for about 6 months. And also kid out Occupy Delaware. That's fair enough. But I had landed a job at Chase. You know, in a week or two, I was going to start something like that. Actually, the day that I handed in my paperwork to explain the arrests on my record, I went to Occupy. I remember I walked down the street, and then I remember looking up from standing there and seeing the Chase building, Chase, and thinking, what the fuck am I doing? I mean, it did give me pause, not enough, but it did, I remember it being a real weird, like, standing in that plaza and under that tent and looking up and looking at Chase and being like, oh, I guess I'm going there. And I did. Very, very weird. But yeah, I like you said, I don't think there is any sort of movement or, like, he hopped right on the rise thing as soon as the pensioners were going to get screwed, even though he had retired right on it. I know that he, and we'll talk about it with some other guests that come in, but I know that he was still had his hand in and followed the Inspector General all the way through to the end last session. So, yeah, I mean, peace be upon him and his family. That's all I can say. I mean, you have a lot of, you're organizing a lot of younger people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of transplants who have moved to Delaware over the course of the last 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years.
We are a certified out-of-state Brooklyn organization, after all.
Look. That's true. But I think, you know, there are enough people around and have been around enough to sort of know the deal with Cuoco, but it's always nice to be, to pick up the flame, pick up the torch and carry it now. But also remembering who carried it for so long when we didn't.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like, that's why, that's a big reason why I wrote about it. And we sent out like a WP newsletter and I included that in there as well, because I do think it's often easy to feel lost when we're doing this work, that we're sort of trying to navigate something that has never been navigated before. And I think one of the purposes of knowing our history and knowing our, I don't want to say ancestors directly. I mean, that's getting to a different type of organizing language that's not really my space, but our ancestors and our, you know, our actual ancestors and our spiritual ancestors, so to speak. It's to show us that, you know, we're not necessarily doing this for the first time and that there's things we can learn from in the past. And, you know, the more we know, the better we can move forward. And nobody kind of knew more about that than John Cuoco.
Yeah. And the other lesson being, not only have people gone down this road, not only have they cut the trail in some sense, in a lot of senses, they didn't give up. Because it is hard to, you know, have the most powerful political organizations in the state try to marginalize you, try to make fun of you, try to be like, you know, try to take away whatever power you have and make a laughingstock of you when you're right. And we, you know, we talk about this a lot, about activists and organizers sort of burnout, whether you're whatever area you're working in, whether it's political, electoral, housing, the pro-Palestinian issue, all of that stuff. People just burn the fuck out. And you have to take care of yourself, but you cannot quit. That's another thing that Kawalko, without having to say it, demonstrated for us. He modeled that behavior for us. To not give a fuck about that. You got to keep going forward. You got to find another way to make the argument. You got to find another reporter who will listen to you bitch and put it in the paper. You got to find a new podcast to come in and record this shit. You know, don't quit. Don't ever give up.
Yeah, we won't.
We won't.
Our hero from RD25 in Newark, Representative John Kawalko.
Well, thank you for that compliment. I don't know if I'm a hero. I just take it very seriously. One thing I take more seriously than anything in my life, I guess, is the sense of responsibility I have when I engage in the job as a state representative. And I can't even imagine the awesome responsibility at a higher level, but I can certainly point to what I feel is a classic example of what I am tasked with, and that is the fact that I'm one of 41 people that writes laws, policies, drafts them, and authors them, and helps pass them that affect the lives of a million people in Delaware. I mean, you just do the math on that. That's pretty darn awesome responsibility to have, and you better embrace it. Otherwise, I don't believe that you should enjoy the privilege of a state paycheck as a legislator if you don't want to embrace that. So it's very simple, my motivation. My motivation is to do as best I can for as many people as I can and to try to stifle what you just referred to in the attitude of the early Virginia, early after, in this decade or in 1900.
Mid-20th century. Folks, we're back. We're going to continue the discussion we've started about the man, the myth, the legend, John Kawalko. And we're going to take a more of a deep dive into like his legacy, what he means, and how we're going to, as Carl put it, how we're going to pick up the flame and how we're going to carry it. So our guests to do that are Medina, who you know is a very famous comedian. hello, Medina.
Hey, guys.
We have a friend and comrade of John for a long time, John Flaherty. Hello.
Hey, thank you for having me, Rob. And I'm looking forward to a good discussion with the three of us, you and I and Medina.
Yeah, and maybe we'll let Bill talk sometimes, too. Bill's on the ones and twos tonight. Yeah. He's stepping in.
Good evening.
Carl's on.
Is he super producer or call him just producer?
Well, he's actually, he's our senior legal correspondent.
Well, yeah, but.
But he just does this when Carl is out on like other duty. We can't really.
Yeah. Discuss. Undisclosed location.
We can't really talk about it.
Yeah. I know where he is, though.
I know where he is, too. Actually, I talked to him like 2 hours ago.
Yeah.
Don't, and everybody listen to this. Don't worry about what he's doing. Okay? Yeah. Don't worry about what we're doing.
Mind your
worry about your own stuff. Maybe if you did more of worrying about your own stuff, about what other people are doing, you wouldn't be in this mess.
Why do I feel like I'm in the back of a minivan?
I'll pull the studio over.
That's right, listeners. Rob's scolding you again. You'll turn this minivan right around. Get it together.
Well, I guess I'm just stalling because I'm an emotional fella. But I actually, if you'll allow me, Medina, I do want to start off with a question for John, because, and we sort of hinted at this before we turned the mics on. Because I don't remember who told me this piece of information. And I think it was Kowalko, but I wasn't positive. The famous photo that ran in the news journal that I saw again, that somebody ran online or posted online after John died, of the people gagged.
Yes.
When he went to the committee and they put the tape over his mouth and all of that. You were involved in that theatrical.
I was the unindicted co-conspirator. You
know? I'm like, I saw the, because he's holding up a piece of paper, and I said, I think John Flannery's behind that piece of paper.
There are three of us: John Kowalko, myself, and Alan Muller. You know, I drove and I got Kowalko. We went down to Delaware, Port Penn. Muller lived in Port Penn. Alan was head of a group called Green Delaware. So we drove down to Dover. This would have been June of 2006.
Mm.
And we're attending a committee hearing on the second floor legislative hall in the House hearing room. And the chairman of the committee was Bob Vallejora. And I think it was a housing issue. I forget exactly what the issue was. But we sat there, and as chairman of the committee, he announced that there was going to be no public comment.
Really?
So, Kowalko and Muller either knew about this or pulled out these tape and wrote, "Don't gag the public," and they put it on their mouth. They didn't say a word, not a word. They just put the tape on it, on their mouth. And Vallejora just went ballistic. He was very angry. "Get out of here right now. I'm going to call the police." So he calls the Capitol Police. And the Capitol policeman shows up to this hearing. It's a legislative hearing. And the policeman comes in, and I knew the officer, nice guy. And he shrugs his shoulders like, what am I doing here, you know? And Vallejora says, "I want those two out of this hearing and out of the building." Well, it was raining outside, and I drove. So I sat there for about 5 or 10 seconds. And so I figured I'd get up, and I was going to follow those two guys out. So Vallejora says to me, "You're not leaving because of sympathy for their views." And I said, "Well, I guess I am, you know." And then he turns to the reporter and said, "Don't you guys print this in the paper tomorrow?"
I love that he did the drill. He did the drill tweet before it was a tweet. He's like, "Oh, do God. Not put in the paper that I was mad." Yes. He actually said, "Don't put in the newspaper that I was mad."
And we all have bad days, and I guess that was a bad day for Vallejora. Why he would do that, I don't know. But the officer escorted Muller and Kowalko out of the building outside where it was raining, and I think I drove my car. I forget who drove. I think I may have driven, but it was raining, so the three of us eventually went home. But you never know. I was watching a show one day, and Charles Barkley was saying, proclaiming he refuses to be a role model. Well, you never know when you're going to be. You have no control over that.
Mm.
So about 4 years ago, I'm talking to Joe Walls. Joe spent probably 30 years as an inmate at Delaware Correctional Center.
We all know Joe.
And he came up and we were talking, and he said, "You know, I have that picture of you, Kowalko, and Muller. I hanged it in my cell in Smyrna." I said, "Oh, my God, that was, 19 years ago, whatever it was." So my point is that, they stuck to their guns. You know, they allowed their displeasure to be known. They didn't utter a word. They didn't disrupt anything. But it inspired a guy like Joe Walls to get involved with that action that Kowalko took that day. It was really, I never really gave it a thought after that. But a lot of people would not have, done that, but that was the way John was. He was not afraid to mix it up.
And, yeah, and Joe Walls is still deep in advocacy and activism now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Listeners will remember during the legislative session earlier this year, we did an episode from Leg Hall at the Ex-Prisoner Lobby Day, lobbying for compassionate release, amongst other things. And Joe was there, obviously. I mean, that goes without saying. But he was also he also helped produce the show. He would get people who had told their stories and were interested in getting part of it or some of it on. So the people that you heard were introduced to me by Joe, and I guess inspired by.
And I think one of Kowalko's legacies that he inspired a lot of people to be involved, to challenge the system, and not be afraid to challenge authority. You know, just because somebody has the status of a chairperson of a committee doesn't mean that they're right or wrong. You know, they have to defeat your arguments with the substance, not with the level of authority they may have over you. And I think Kowalko inspired not only Joe Walls but many other people to be involved, to do stuff, and not be afraid to challenge.
Well, speaking of people who were inspired to do things, Medina, you're actually doing the thing he did. Yeah, it's wild. I want to ask you this, and I just want to ask it now because I think it'll generate a long conversation. And I'm not asking for you to say yes or no, but I want to kind of pick apart the idea because Carl and I talked about it, and I don't know if it'll be in the opening part or not. Of all the people that are carrying the flame in the place where and in the manner in which John carried it, everybody looks at you like it's on you. Now, that's not really true. That's just not how it works. What do you think about it?
About people looking to me? I mean,
or about sort of the person who is, let's just be honest, a leader, a real leader.
I mean,
somebody who's going to set the tone. And set the limits of the agenda. Like, that's the way I look at it. And somebody has to do that there, the way that John did it, I think. And that's sort of what you do. And again, I don't look at it like, you know, you're taking over, getting like promoted to a position or anything. But you do that.
Yeah, I mean. You know, we're all here to talk about John. So I'm gonna be a politician, but also just be a friend and mentee and protege in how I answer that. In that, like John just said, a lot of us look up to John Kowalko, and he inspired, I mean, our cohort, I'll say, right, in the legislature, but so many people beyond that, others who ran and weren't successful in winning, but are still active in the community. And, you know, I'll go back in time a bit, and it's not quite to 2006, but to 2016 when I first met John. I was a young, bright-eyed Democrat, you know, liberal, who thought Barack Obama was the best president ever. And I was inspired by John Kowalko, and I was kind of just, like, in awe of him, and I think a lot of us were. And then I moved into the 25th district. I was on the RD committee with him. And that was where I got to actually get to know him as a person. And it was an honor. Like, it was an honor to know him. It was an honor to get to work with him in different ways. And the, like, turning point in our relationship was one day when I was on staff, and I wasn't working for John. I was working for somebody else. I saw that there was going to be an Israel resolution on the agenda. And so I went to John Kowalko as his constituent. And I was like, I know I work here, and, like, this might not be, you know, correct for me to do, but I'm going to advocate to you as my state rep and ask you not to support this. And we had some back and forth about it. He was like, all right, you know, you're right. What do you want me to do? Like, what do you want from your state rep in this moment? And I told him, I was like, if they're going to run it, this line's got to get crossed out, and this line's got another. Like, I gave him all the edits, and he went and met with the sponsor of it. Came back, he was like, "They're not even going to run it," because he was like, after pushing back, they didn't want to run the bill. The resolution changed, basically, and that was like kind of the beginning of a new stage in our relationship where he saw me as someone who was passionate about things like he was, and he was thinking about retiring at that time, and he asked me to run in his district, and I was like, I think I'm going to move back home to my hometown area and run there eventually, maybe. But it was really an honor to work with him. After he retired, he would call me a lot and bug the crap out of me.
I had a certain kind of feel, because, you know, I'm sure he didn't call me as much as he called you, but whenever I saw it, it was like the bat phone going off. I'm like, somebody did something
for me. No, he was always like, there was always something happening, and he wanted me to know what his thoughts were, or he wanted me to know that, like, he had my back. Like, I have trying to, like, you know, keep it together and not get emotional on here, but he was always really direct with me about how he felt about how I was doing in the role. And I got to say, no offense to anybody else, but I don't really care what anybody thought besides him, because he was that kind of a leader. And there were moments where he would apologize to me for retiring, which was like a bittersweet feeling, because he'd be like, "Ah, I feel like I left you down there alone." But then it's like, yeah, well, I don't want you to be down here in the shitter with us either. Like, I want you to live your life, John. Yeah, but
you stuck your head out of the trench enough, right?
Yeah. So, like, it was really an honor to work with him. It was a blessing to have him for as long as we had him. And I really appreciate that he was someone who was honest about how he felt and communicated it, right? Like, I'm sure we all have relationships with folks in our lives that we love and care for that just never actually vocalize how they felt about us. And then you kind of wonder when they're gone. And he was always so generous and being real with me. And it's such a blessing. And I have some voicemails from him from times when I was driving and I was like, I don't have time to talk to him right now because he's going to annoy me. And then the messages are him saying how proud he was and to keep up the good work. And then he'd be like, who down there should I give money to? Because I don't really know, you know, how they are. They seem right. But like, how are they down there? Should I send them my money? One of the last voicemails I have from him was him saying, like, I'm only going to send them money if you've okayed them.
That's incredible.
So, yeah, I'm going to save those. But, you know, being in leadership, I think you have to check yourself. And just because John was proud of me at this point doesn't mean that I'm not going to make mistakes, that I'm not going to, you know, get off track at some point. And so I just try to stay grounded with the gentleman like you guys that I'm hanging out with right now. And like, I think John was really, he was really happy that there were so many other progressives that got down there. And I think he felt a bit like he missed out on that, right? Because he was down there by himself for so long. But we have to keep up that momentum that we've been building, that he helped establish with guys like John and Alan and everybody else for years. So it's exciting. And I think it was a blessing for all of us that he was able to hang out with us long enough to see us have some of those wins, to get the Inspector General bill passed, to get, you know, just to like show that the work he put in and the effort that the community put in for all those years wasn't for naught.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a shame that the federal level things are not going in the right direction, but at least here in Delaware, I think John's legacy is alive and well. But he's going to be missed. He's going to be missed a lot.
Rob, let me tell you a specific, if I could, a John Kowalko story from 2009. John was on the Sunset Committee, and the Sunset Committee that was chaired at the time by Senator Dave Sekola. So they were reviewing an obscure agency, the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. They were reviewing that, and they had recommendations to reform it. And they came out with a different name, and they had a bunch of deals to reform it. So Sokol introduced the bill, and I believe Senator Adams promptly put it, and he was chairman of the executive committee, and he put the bill in the desk drawer, and that's where it stayed in the Senate. There were a lot of people involved with that committee that did not want to see this bill see the light of day. So Kowalka was on the Sunset Committee, and it's rare that anybody ever challenges leadership down there. So when John heard that the bill in the Senate was essentially dead, he introduced the same bill in the House, and it passed unanimously in the House. It went over to the Senate, and Patty Blevins helped out quite a bit, but they tried to deep six it, and it was getting towards the end of the session, and it had not come up for a committee hearing or anything. They needed Senate action, and they needed the bill to pass without any amendments. So on June 30th, I used to go down there and anchor myself on a seat on the floor and see what was going on. And I noticed a whole number of domestic violence advocates were in the hall, and they were lobbying for the bill. And former Attorney General Rich Gebelein was there. And it was getting late. It was past midnight. And next thing I know, the Senate bill, I think Senator Blevins stood up and asked that the bill, they waive the rules and bring the bill up for a vote in the Senate. Well, that's unheard of, the challenge to leadership. They didn't want this bill passed. So Blevins, I think, made the motion to suspend the rules, and it passed. And the bill came up, and it passed. I said, holy smokes, about 1:30 in the morning. So I got looking for John. John's down by the house somewhere, and I said, John, you're not going to believe it. Your bill passed. You challenged the leadership, and you won. You know, it was incredible. And he was his biggest legacy, his role model as willing to stick his neck out for what was right. And he didn't really care what the good old boys in the Senate thought about him doing that. It's rare that you would openly challenge a Senate leadership by introducing an identical bill that had been killed in the Senate and the House. And they did not like it one bit, and they did not like it when it passed, but it did pass. And through John's daring do, it was a success.
One of the things that we talk about, which, you know, some people can do because they're confident, they sort of have they have moral courage, and they're comfortable in their role that he was in, is that authenticity that he had, because he knew that he didn't have to do pretense. He didn't have to do it because he was a real one. Do you know what I mean? It seems like a cliche, but he was real.
Yeah.
You know, as I said to Carl, like, the biggest lesson that he taught me was bullshit detecting. Like, if somebody's not, you know, if somebody's not being real, just call them out for it. Because you're always on, when you're telling the truth, you're always on solid ground. You know, they can try to marginalize you or
right.
make fun of you or take you off your committees, but when you're a confident person, you're like, well, of course you're going to do that because, you know. And that's the way he just took it and continued to battle in his own authentic, genuine way. And that's the real lesson, and I think more and more people are sort of coming around to that, I think. I hope there's more of it.
Well, I think Kowalka's background is so different than most people in the legislature. He went to St. Joseph Prep High School, which is like an Archimere Academy type school, and then he went to work in the Navy shipyard. He essentially spent his entire life as a blue collar worker, as a machinist. He worked up at the Navy Yard. He worked down here at the refinery. And then he went to work for repairing the assembly line in the Philadelphia Inquirer Distribution Center. So he had a really good background in educational background, coupled with the realities of a blue-collar work life. And so it was kind of like a no big deal to challenge these guys, because he spent his whole life challenging the managers at various places he worked at. And it's rare that you have somebody a legislator with such a blue-collar background as Cuoco had for years. And I used to tease him about his vocabulary. I mean, John, nobody talks like that. I mean, his lexicon of the words. I mean, where'd you get this stuff from, you know? It was really amazing that he could pull that stuff out of there. And to his credit, he was able to use his real-life experiences to in his legislative role in Dover. And I remember before he got elected, he was very active in, you remember Acorn, a group called Acorn?
We do, and actually we talk about it. I'm pretty sure some of it got recorded, as a matter of fact, with Carl, because, anyway, Carl has read the book about Acorn, and we had a sort of a conversation about it relative to the fact that he did activism for the Acorn.
Yeah,
folks,
John was very active with Acorn, and he and Darlene Battle spent many were involved in all kinds of issues. This is before he ran in 2006, and he was like a ball of fire. First time I met him was at a dinner. Jack and Gemma Buckley.
The bookstore. They're in the bookstore.
Nice Street bookstore, and it was Jack and Gemma, myself, and my partner Marianne McGonigal. And Karen Peterson and Vicky Bandy were there. And John talked the entire night. He had all kinds, a million and one ideas, you know. He's thinking about running for the state legislature. And I never met John before. And he had just a boundless reservoir of energy.
Yes.
And it was really something to behold. And he was able to use that quite effectively once he got elected. And that's where I first met him, and you know, he went on to he ran against Stephanie Ulbrich, who was probably going to be on the. There were five Republicans that lost that year. They all were going to be on the Joint Finance Committee, and she was one of them. And she did not want to lose. She really wanted to be on the JFC. She was chairman of the Sunset Committee.
She got Sunset.
Yeah,
her Sunset.
Can I share a story that someone put on Facebook?
Sure.
So I hope this is okay. It was on Facebook, so I think it's okay to share. Debbie Gottschalk. If you're listening, you were John's favorite.
Who is this?
She's a drafting attorney.
Okay.
In the legislature.
Right. Okay.
Amazing drafting attorney. Amazing person. But if she didn't know this, John raved about her all the time, as being just dependable and amazing and compassionate and all the things. And so she posted on Facebook, "I had the privilege of John's friendship for over 20 years, working together first when I was the manager of Classy's housing unit, and he was a passionate housing advocate volunteering with Acorn, and then later as a drafting attorney for legislation he sponsored. One of my favorite memories of John is when he called me at home on a Saturday morning, excited because the tenant he had advocated for at an administrative hearing had won, and her Newark Housing Authority lease was not going to be terminated. With a copy of a case I provided, he assisted the tenant at the hearing because no one at Classy was available to attend. He was so excited when I told him that I was deputizing him as a member of Classy's housing unit. A few years later, he helped many more Delawareans keep their homes by leading the creation of the initial foreclosure mediation program." And I wanted to share that because I feel like it's the perfect example of the type of leader that John was. Like John Flaherty here was stating earlier. He was kind of the perfect legislator in that he was big picture and he also was on the ground doing the, you know, heavy lifting too. And this example that Debbie shared, shows that, you know, he was big picture. He thought had the big ideas. He got the legislation done to help a lot of people, but he also spent the time and effort to go and help the individual and show up for them. And that was the kind of legislator that he was, the kind of person that he was. The last time that I saw him, he showed up to my community day, completely unexpected, with a whole entourage in a wheelchair, right? And it was in the park. And so they wheeled him out, and he just made the effort. He went the extra mile. And, you know, he was exceptional in that way. And I think a lot of us look to him as an example of the best kind of legislator you can be. To show up, to listen to your community, to help people at the individual level, but then to also bring all of those stories with you when you get to Dover and pass bills that help thousands, if not millions.
Yeah, we talk about, like, you know, the fights that he had on different issues. I love that he was deputized as a classy attorney. That's pretty great. But he, less, you know, people forget because he was, you know, demonized, you know, set to the side, removed from his committees and all that. But he knew what the hell he was talking about. I mean, he would produce budgets so that when people said, like, how are we going to pay for this? He'd be like, this is how.
Right.
Now, you know, obviously it's all sort of like a little game back and forth. Like, they're just, they didn't think he would do it, and he did it. You know, it's like, we're going to ask you how you're going to pay for it, and then it'll die. Well, you're not going to get me. I'll show you how we're going to do it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I just, he was tenacious.
Yeah, committed.
Really committed and tenacious.
I mean, it takes hours to do that. Like, and I don't know if you've mentioned this on the episode yet, but even after retiring, he didn't really retire because the state, the state, messed up with retiree health care.
Yeah,
right. And he and other members of the community rose up to support retirees. And I remember being on the phone with him. It may have even been a Zoom call over the summer. And it was like him and his wife, Connie, his
Shout
amazing
Connie.
Better half, and Eric, and I think Paul Bomback. And he was going off, and he was like, we got to do this, and we got to do this. And he was like, and if I had known this was in there, I wouldn't have voted for it, because it was like right after he retired. And he put so much time and effort into it, and I know he wasn't feeling well. Like, I know he was dealing with health issues, but he put in time and effort and his skills and his heart and soul into helping others.
Because he believed it didn't matter that he was retired.
Yeah.
You know, that's the stuff that he believed in.
And he was one of his recurring... it's fun. I don't know why it's funny now, but one of his recurring offers to me, he was always like, well, yeah, you're doing a great job, Medina. You're doing a great job. If you need me to write anything, like, if you need me to like, put my name on anything you're doing, like, I don't know, like, letter to the editor, like,
you need a job
if
recommendation.
If you need me to, like, stamp it.
When he would call me to talk about an issue or something that was going on, we would talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. And that's the other thing. Since you mentioned Connie, I think it's fair to say he also had a sort of that relationship with his wife. And shout out Connie, where we would be talking about something, and she'd be like, no, you didn't do it. You took that paragraph out.
Yeah,
you can hear her yelling in the background, yelling him notes in the back. So I'm sure you guys have all had that experience. So
Every once in a while, he'd be like, Connie's here. And I'm like, I know.
she'd be like,
Medina, John's here. And I'm like, I know. I know you guys are like... Yeah,
but he would always say at the end of those conversations something. He's like, you know, I'll come on the podcast anytime. I got a million of them. You know, one of those things. He's like, you know, whatever's going on, I have an opinion. I'll speak on it.
Yeah.
You know, he was always ready, you know, to turn up for you.
And there are a few times where, like, in the last year, he'd call me and he'd be like, so what's this I hear about XYZ? And I'd be like, I don't even know what you're talking about. You got the scoop before me. He'd be like, all right, well, I'll see if I can find it.
I'm not going to say exactly what he said, but literally 3 weeks ago, maybe, he had called me as I was setting up, and so I didn't take the call. We're setting up. Carl and Bill are here. I played the voicemail to these guys, and he was like, hey, are you hearing anything about XYZ? Because if this person's involved, it's a goddamn disgrace.
I think it's the same thing that he called me about. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about.
He
you got
be
your
like,
ear to the ground.
He's
man.
Like, what's happening? Yeah. What a great. I just remember a lot of those conversations.
You know, over his career, John had a few important victories and many, many defeats.
Mm.
But one of his, I think his biggest victory was a non-legislative victory. Was down in Newark around 2015 or 16. I ran into this guy named Nick Wasileski, who I work with pretty good now. They wanted to build a power plant at the Star Campus where Chrysler Factory was.
Yes, the Newark power plant.
Well, Cuoco was probably the only one of 62 legislators that openly opposed it. Everybody was, you know, this is the best thing since sliced bread. So Cuoco worked with Nick Wasileski and Amy Rowe and Jen Wallace, a whole bunch of people down there in Newark. And I think Bomback was on our side also. But except for those two guys, it was those two against 60 legislators. The Joint Finance Committee supported this project. Governor Markell supported it. But it really just goes to show you that if you stick to your guns and you organize and you, you know, rally the troops, that you can defeat issues like this. And they did not want that power plant. It would have been a huge power plant right there in the parking lot of the Star Campus. And without Kewalko's leadership and his stick to it, they would have built that.
Well, there's a lot to learn about that, particularly right now, because I think there's the data center issue is going to parallel that very closely.
Yeah.
There's going to be a huge push for that. We're already seeing, like, Meyer go out and say stuff and some money coming in and being like, hey, you're going to need these data centers. They're good. This technology, AI. That's all fake, first of all. This is what John taught me. You can differentiate between bullshit that you're getting and fact. And so people should really look at an issue like that, because we're going to that's a fight that's on the horizon.
If you take a look at these small modular reactors, is there anywhere in the world they're producing electricity? There isn't any. They tried one out in Utah. They had like 23 municipalities signed on to this small modular reactor. This company, NuScale, got, I think, $1 billion in assistance from the feds, and then it collapsed. It's just not a viable deal. And these things are not, when they talk about small, I've seen pictures of them. They take up a lot of land. They are huge. They may not be as big as Salem and Hope Creek, but they're not little. And I think I testified at the task force just the other day, and hopefully that they'll take a look at the, everybody's saying, you know, we got to have more electricity because of the data centers. Well, maybe we do, but we don't need nuclear as a remedy for a data center. And I think Kewalko would probably be leading that fight if he was around here.
Yeah, and another thing about Kewalko, we didn't even agree on everything all the time. Medina and I don't agree on everything all the time, but we actually all get along because there's a understanding of what we're up to.
Yeah, and that's why mutual respect.
Yeah, I actually think nuclear power is actually might be good. But that's a whole nother story. Yeah. But that's something that we would talk about, because I know where he's coming from, and he would know where I'm coming from, rather than sort of like just taking a position for political expedience.
Oh, that's the first time that I don't remember what we argued about, but that I think is when John and I actually became kind of friends, was on the RD. I remember we argued about endorsing someone. He wanted to endorse somebody. I didn't think it was a good idea. And I was like the only one pushing back. And he was like, who is this person? But yeah, I mean, mutual respect, shared values. We can talk. We can argue.
Yeah.
And realize that we're, you know, not the other person isn't evil. The other person doesn't have some kind of ulterior motive. I don't want to speak ill of the dead, so I'm not going to put too much detail on this. But I will say, John introduced me to many sayings about the people that he did not like. And a lot of them are attempting to memorialize him and stuff. And it's like, it's kind of driving me up at a wall seeing certain people be like, oh, may he rest in peace. And I'm like,
but again,
he hated you.
Yes.
And you know it.
Yeah, let's be very clear.
He hated your stinking guts.
And I think
he told me visually what he would do if he saw you on fire.
Yeah.
He hated you.
Yeah, and I think we would do him a disservice.
Very illustrative.
I think we would do him a disservice if we did not say unequivocally that a lot of you out there, he hated your guts. And most of the same people I hate, which you already know, he did not like you either.
No, no.
And you can also, if you want to ponder it, no one would ever, you know, when you die, no one's ever going to talk to you about you like this, because you're fake.
You're boring.
Yeah, you're boring. You have nothing. You really have nothing to offer. You make sort of small arguments for political expediency, and so you can get your picture taken at the Sussex County Fair or something. And that's just not the way Kewalko operated.
No.
And he did it to the very end, too, like you said.
He was real, he was real, he was raw, and it was refreshing. At times, startling, I will say. Like, as a new legislator, I remember he called me about, like, some interaction in Dover, and he just was, like, going off. And I was like, oh, my God, John. Like, John, I've never heard anyone say that before. But, I mean, yeah, you're right. This person is not good. It's not a good person. And, you know, if you feel like I'm talking about you, if you feel like John may have been talking about you, he probably was. And maybe, I don't know, think about your actions, you know. Imagine you're in the back of a minivan, like earlier. Imagine your dad is telling you how disappointed he is. What would you do in that situation? And then apply that to your life now. But yeah, there was a lot of people that we worked with down there that he did not like at all. And it wasn't because of some petty reason. It was because they were obstacles in helping the community. They chose to be obstacles either because they were so inept and intellectually lazy, or because they were just, you know, just out of malice because they wanted money and power and prestige. And I remember one of the first conversations that I had with someone before I was running, like as I was deciding to run, they said, I hope that you don't become like Kowalko. And I just want you all to know, now that he's passed, I will become even more annoying.
Yes.
This is my promise to you. So
he would have.
If I haven't been like Kowalko yet, I will be becoming more like him. That is my goal.
Yeah, it should be very clear to everyone that, especially building on the themes that Carl sort of wrote down, people are going to pick up the torch here. I mean, we've already been doing it. We've sort of it's been a transition, I guess, and that's sort of what we're all experiencing together. But we're transitioning to do what we know, because he didn't like put on pretenses with us. We know what he wants us to do, and we're gonna. And goddamn it, we're gonna do it.
You know, Rob and I were talking earlier, and I used to kid Kowalko about this. I said, John, there's a movie out there that reminds me of you. It came out in 1967. Paul Newman played this guy, Luke, and the movie was called Cool Hand Luke. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie.
You remember, you know what Luke gets arrested. So the Paul Newman character gets thrown into a work camp in like Georgia.
Yeah.
In the 50s. He's
an inmate. He cut the head off a parking meter and got caught. And
he was really drunk and he had a pipe cutter and he was cutting the heads off of parking meters.
To get and quarters or something?
I don't even know
what?
If he was getting
they
the quarters. I think
quarters
he was just like
then.
Drunk and just, he was just doing it for fun.
Pennies yeah. back then?
If I remember, I think he was just doing it for fun.
Yeah, he was, and you know, and John was not an inmate or a criminal, but the movie talks about Paul Newman's character Luke confronting the warden, played by this guy Strother Martin, and he's always challenging the people, and he's always getting beat up, and he has to dig a grave and redig a grave, but he never gets beaten. He just keeps coming back, and I said, John, you remind me of Cool Hand Luke. No matter how many times you lose, you keep coming back.
Right.
And he had that stick-to-itiveness, that ability to inspire others. And that movie was 50-some years ago, and we used to laugh about it, particularly at the end we talked about, I'm shaking it, boss scene, you know.
Great movie, by the way, if you guys haven't seen Cool Hand Luke. It's very good.
It won an Academy Award, but... Kowalko had that ability to fight and to inspire others to go with him, even if it was not going to be successful. He'd come back the next year.
Yeah, he didn't let it. He used it for fuel almost. Like if he took a hard beat, and as you said, we take a lot of hard losses, you know, in this kind of with our sort of like with our theory of large sort of. Change, we take a lot of losses, but he never seemed to look defeated.
No, he never got discouraged. He just
never
kept
got
going.
Discouraged. Yeah. He just the next year he got on it again. Some of it was the same. Sometimes he would change sort of depending on what was going on, or just to be supportive or oppositional as a voice of the people for whatever topic was happening. But yeah, he never got really down or discouraged. He was like, I'm just going to go back at it, I guess. That's what
I mean,
he did.
Can I offer a little contrast there?
Well, I know in private he did.
Yeah, but so let's see. I think in line with what we've already said about John, right? He was genuine about what he was doing. It wasn't about him. It wasn't about power or prestige or any of those things, right? And for the loyal listener, this might feel redundant, but there's a poem by I.F. Stone that we talked about like maybe a year ago. I don't know. But I think it's the perfect, you know, reminder for us in the fight that we're in. And I think John was the fighter that it talks about. The only kinds of fights worth fighting are those you're going to lose because someone has to fight them and lose and lose and lose until someday somebody who believes as you do wins. In order for someone to win an important major fight 100 years hence, a lot of other people have got to be willing, for the sheer fun and joy of it, to go right ahead and fight, knowing you're going to lose. You mustn't feel like a martyr. You've got to enjoy it. If that's not John, to a T, right? He fought over and over, and I think was blessed to be able to see some of those fights turn to wins. Before he retired, after he retired, before he passed. But we have to keep fighting, not knowing if we're going to get to see that or not, you know? But yeah, this reminded me of him.
You know, a good example would be, I think it was your first term down there, 2022. He had introduced a bill many years ago regarding flame retardants in furniture being kid-proof and stuff. Well, he probably first introduced the bill in 2011, and it finally passed and got signed in 2022, probably one of the last things he did down there. So he stuck with this one issue for 12 years, you know, meeting disdain from the Chamber of Commerce, from this legislator, you can't tell companies what to do, blah, 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 blah. And he just stuck to it, and he finally was successful with that. And very few people know anything about flame retardant material. I'm not sure how he got into that, but he not only got into it, and he stuck to it, and eventually it paid off when the bill passed and the governor eventually signed it into law. So you need that kind of stick to it down there. And a lot of people won't stick to it. I mean, they'll you know, come down there for a day, a week, or whatever, and they'll, I'm not going to come back here. I'm just going to go home. But Caulker had that determination, that ability to just stick with it and not get discouraged. And he succeeded with that. I mean, he put a lot of bills in over the years, income tax bill, budget bills. They didn't get passed, but he introduced them in the next session, and he got people thinking.
Right. Well, apparently there's going to be this budget gap, and we're going to be using Caulker's name once again when this budget gap comes up, because we need income tax brackets that make sense here in the year of our Lord 2025. Mm-hmm. Caulker again showed us the way, and we're going to be using his work very soon. At least I am, because that's what I'm advocating for, and I think everybody should be. That should be part of some kind of revenue package. And, you know, his work will continue very shortly on something very specific. So, you know, I don't want to cut you guys off if you have another story. Give you the opportunity to say whatever else you want to say. I got the news from you, Medina. Looking at Medina. I've tried to, as I got older, to be less sentimental, because I realize stuff comes and goes. Like, as you get older, it becomes apparent, like, I'm not going to be able to break down every time something like this happens, because it happens. That's what happens. And so, like, there was this, like, delayed reaction until, like, today.
Take your time.
But I was telling I was telling John before you guys came in, and I don't know if I ever said it, but I was adamant that if Cuoco ran for governor, that we would run the Wilmington office out of this house. I said, I'll do whatever we have to do.
Yeah.
I was telling Drew Sirius, I'm like, we'll bring in extra beds. I was saying crazy shit. Cause you know, I've hosted like Justice Democrat types and stuff here when they've done canvassing and stuff. So I was all gung ho. I was like, this is going to be Cuoco Central. And so, and that's the thing, like, you guys had different relationships with him, and you guys have all the good stories, so I guess that's kind of getting to me, too. He was just my friend, kind of. I mean, he was my friend, but, yeah, I'm just going to miss him.
Yeah. John was a man of character, integrity, leadership, and he's going to be sorely missed.
Yeah.
He was a good man, real good man.
Well, peace be upon him, and I think he would appreciate that left is best.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to go to Representative Cuoco for a few comments.
Representative Cuoco. Thank you. Mr. Speaker, may I have the privilege of the floor for a brief comment?
Granted.
I've had the privilege and pleasure of serving as a state representative for almost 16 years. As you all might know, this is my second career. For 37 years, I was a machinist. I was a proud union member during that time, serving as a union official and advocate. I worked at the Delaware City Refinery for 25 years, serving as a union steward and a general foreman. These experiences gave me a solid foundation for rules of order and their importance, the power of solidarity, and a profound respect for working men and women and their families. I have held these values that are so dear to me throughout my career as a legislator. I am proud of my continuous and resolute support for not only organized labor, but for all working people and their families, and for all of Delaware citizens. My bills and the bills I put my name on support ordinary people, working people, parents, children, the homeless, and Delaware small business community. I have always supported government transparency, good government, and open government. I have always supported and sponsored bills improving health care, voting rights, gender equity, and the environment. I have met some amazing people throughout the years, and I am honored by the trust people have placed in me, ranging from neighbors on my street, very own street, to being featured in the French news media regarding transparency and corporate giveaways. I was privileged to be one of just four U.S. legislators invited to England at the British government's expense for a series of discussions with government officials that included visits to offshore wind sites and universities that had training programs for engineers and craftsmen dedicated to offshore wind technology. I was humbled and honored to share a mutually respectful friendship with former Governor Russell Peterson, truly one of the most accomplished environmental advocates in Delaware. Being a legislator has been both awe-inspiring and humbling, and I am proud of the fact that I have remained a full-time legislator, never using my position in Dover to augment my career or income. When I was first elected, Democrats were in the basement. We were a distinct minority party. I have been there. I am proud that Democrats hold a significant majority today. I was a founding member of the Progressive Dems for Delaware, and I'm especially proud of my work for the progressive movement, furthering its ideals, encouraging, mentoring, and supporting progressive candidates for office all over the state and country. Many of you are in these halls with me today. I'm announcing my retirement at the end of my term. There is a time for everyone to pass the baton, and this term is my time. I'm counting on my fellow progressives to continue my efforts
I will work hard for my constituents for the last 9 months. And in November, I will pass my position as the 25th District Representative over to a new and hopefully just as progressive successor. Thank you very much.